Thank you, Julia. Yeah, so that's our part on the Arabic. There are some terms to explain at the beginning, I suppose. There is the term Islamic codicology, that's kind of probably the most popular, or codicology of manuscripts in Arabic script. Now, I want to explain a little bit the correlation of these two. For that, I need to throw a quote onto you, as one does in the most conventional way. But this quote has got some very interesting points on which I would like to dwell, and that's why I used it. First of all, it talks about the vast number of manuscripts in Arabic script. It talks about the fact that manuscripts in Arabic script go across traditions and religions and languages, perhaps. And it basically gives you a notion that there is a need of there is a need of computing or calculation, a need of counting, or in some ways applying other methodologies to working with them. So this is a map in where you see the Arabic writing system is the darker the color, the more prevalent the writing system, but it really stretches across and includes a great variety of traditions in many different ways, not just in the way of how a manuscript is made physically, but also its content and script and the material it was used, the material that was used to make it. And Arabic is the second language, the second writing system by countries of distribution before just after Chinese. Chinese is the second by number of people using it, and Arabic by the distribution of countries. So it is extremely widely used, and therefore it's quite difficult to give a very short summary of a codicological tradition, as it were. So a little bit about the script. It originates... Do you hear me? Do I need this microphone? Okay, go ahead. So the origins of the Arabic script go back to the Nabatean, the tradition of writing, especially the Nabatean dialect, with influence from the Syriac ligatures at the ground level. So the cursive nature of the Arabic script is known to have come from the Syriac. And really, the Arabic script developed together with the use of the Arabic written culture with the advent of Islam. Although there are earlier evidences of Arabic writing, especially in multilingual inscriptions, but the tradition of Arabic as a written culture is very contemporary to the advent of Islam. Just to give you a little bit of an idea of what the script looks like, for those of you who don't know it, now this is all printed, I didn't want to throw manuscripts at you right at this stage. And I thought to give you a little introduction about what a comparative approach would be. And I thought that most of you may be most familiar with the Western tradition, and that's where I started off. So we have a lot in common in the Middle Eastern manuscript tradition with the Western tradition. We also have codices, i.e. Bound books, as opposed to scrolls. I will talk a little bit more about formats later. Supports are papyrus, parchment, and paper, and not necessarily wood, palm leaf, or other kind of materials. Bindings are also in a way that the quires are sewn together, like in the Western tradition, and inks are, again, made in very similar ways. So we have illustrations and illuminations in manuscripts. Whereas there are various formats that are quite different. And for parchment manuscripts, for example, there is one rule, the rule of Gregory. I don't know how many of you are familiar with that. It's the way parchment manuscripts are organized, probably because the parchment that was used in the Western tradition came from a large piece, perhaps from the cow. So the practice of folding the sheet and then cutting it created a certain specific order of the flesh and skin side, which we know as the rule of Gregory. And this is something which we find is significantly different with Islamic Arabic manuscripts, where they must have been reordered. So we always have a flesh and skin side facing each other, except for in the middle of the choir. Then paper is one of the major aspects of a different characteristic in Middle Eastern manuscripts, and I will talk a little bit about this later, and so are these further terms. Formats we find in the very early tradition, which is mainly the written Quran. So the earliest books that we find and most research on Arabic paleography is really concerned with the text of the Quran, in which we have various formats like this oblong format, for example, and the bindings. But there are also formats like this, the accordion book, or the rotulus, and was mentioned earlier today. What we don't have is the scroll, like in the Jewish tradition, or in also in the Western tradition, where you have a piece of vellum stitched together. But and end bands in the most functional way, as opposed to just a decorative way, it's a very significant feature. Here you can see something that you may have seen earlier before in the talk on Chinese manuscripts, that the way the choirs are arranged is very similar to that. It's unfortunate we can't really go into more detail on that, but I think there was a discussion around where did the gathering of choirs into a book, where did that tradition in the Chinese manuscript tradition actually come from? And it's quite interesting to observe the similarity between the Chinese and Central Asian codices to the Middle Eastern Islamic codices, as opposed to the Western style of binding. Then we have parchment. Here you see there is this flesh and skin side opposition I was mentioning earlier. So we have various ways in which parchment was used, similar to the Western tradition. This is a very exceptional piece. I just brought it here for decorative purposes. It's a huge Quran from Central Asia, and it actually, strictly speaking, doesn't count as a choir because they're single sheets sewn together at the back. So it's not really a codex, although it looks like a book. These are one of the earliest fragments of the Quran in Hijazi script from probably the first two centuries that we have, that clearly suggests the existence of choirs and a codex. And this is another very unique piece, the so-called blue Quran, where nobody is quite sure why it is blue and how it was actually prepared. And an image of a palimpsest that is in Cambridge, copied in the monastery in Sinai, St. Catherine's Monastery, which again suggests the format of choir gathering. Paper, another important phenomena in that most likely contributes to the vastness of Arabic script, Arabic manuscripts and Arabic script, because paper was introduced to the Islamic world in the mid-8th century. It's more of a legend than historical evidence that puts the beginning of it to the Battle of Talas, when the Chinese army was besieged by the Arabs, and Chinese artisans taught the Arabs the papermaking techniques. And from there on, it traveled through up to Egypt, where gradually paper mills were established in the region of Samarkand, Baghdad, Damascus, and Cairo, until it was adopted by the Christian West in Italy in the mid-13th century. So from the mid-8th to the mid-13th century, paper was made within the Islamicate world. And therefore, massive amounts of manuscripts were produced because paper was a lot easier to produce and much cheaper. And so although the principal way of making paper hasn't really changed until industrial paper came into, was invented, but there are of course very many fine differences in the raw materials that were used in different places based on availability, the environmental circumstances, the amount of water that was there, and so on. But the main thing is that Oriental paper, someone mentioned it today, I think it was about the Armenian manuscripts, yeah, Oriental paper, what we understand under Oriental paper is paper that is handmade, of course, in this way, with a movable frame. So, and this is really the main difference I wanted to draw on here to Western paper, which is made on a fixed frame. I mean, Western paper really revolutionized the way paper was made, and in the end also took over and, in a way, eradicated the making of oriented paper as such, because it was much more efficient. So Western paper is made on a fixed frame with wires, and in there you knit in those ornaments, which then later become watermarks, which is not possible with oriented paper, because as you can see, there is not much to wave in. And also that's why oriented paper doesn't have chain lines, because of the missing fixed frame and, you know, that bit. So, therefore, oriental paper doesn't have watermarks, ever. if anyone claims having seen a watermark on oriental paper, they just didn't know how to distinguish oriental paper from Western paper. That's basically the difference. And another very specific feature was that paper was habitually burnished. It was sized and burnished. And even later, when Western paper took over in the Middle East and was imported to the Middle East and paper making kind of decreased more and more, the Western paper was also burnished. François de Roche, who I will mention a bit later, claims this was purely for aesthetic reasons, but I'm sure, and many others have also stated, that it also had a purpose because of the way the ink and the colors, and that brings me to tools, used to was the sliding of the colors was facilitated by a much smoother surface. And as Arabic is a joined-up cursive script, it was, that's why experimental paleography, who mentioned it today, is actually really useful, because when you are trying to do the writing, apparently the calamus was dipped in the ink once, and with that, the ink that was on the calamus, the entire raw, or at least a good number of letters should have been written until the word is finished. So the paper should have been smooth, not as absorbed as it would have been. And inks, again, we have here, who knows what that is? The gallnuts, yeah. So iron gall inks were very common in the first centuries when support was mainly still on parchment, but later with the use of paper, carbon inks were used more and more because iron gall had a very kind of corrosive quality. Another peculiarity is the ruling and tools for ruling. So you find that a lot in Oriental, Middle Eastern, Islamic manuscripts on Arabic script, however you want to call it. A bit difficult to sum them up, really. There was a very typical tool for ruling, which is called the mistara. You can see it's a board with cords spin around, which was often put under the choirs, hammered in, or pressed along to create an indent that is still visible. And I find it remarkable with manuscripts that are like 600 years old or so, and you still very clearly see the indentation of that. And a little bit on layouts. We have the colophon as well, so I'm very grateful to your presentation because it is very much the same as what you find in Islamic manuscripts. And therefore, it's very useful to have colloquia like this one, for example, where we really bring together all these different traditions. And I think it helps us to understand that the more dividing we are, the more segregational we are in our approach, the less we progress, I would say. And there are so many commonalities that are quite interesting to use in comparison. So this is not the prettiest example of a colophon, I'm afraid. there are some magnificent ones, and we have the same as from the Armenian tradition, we're presenting double ones and triple ones and some that go over the whole page, but just to give you an idea. And very typical for ornamented manuscripts are these opening pages. Again, the unwans, the headings of a text are often illuminated, whereas in the later, like from the 15th, 16th, definitely 17th century onwards, where the production of manuscript went up really in numbers incredibly, you find a lot of manuscripts in our libraries which have the space left out for this decoration, and the decoration was never actually fulfilled. So that suggests also the way the production of manuscripts was happening. So the scribe, you had the papermaker, the person who created the choirs perhaps, then they were ruled, and the layout was predetermined, then the scribe and the illuminator finished off, perhaps before the binding was done. This is another example of a text with commentaries, again very typical, and a very early example of a Quranic text which is framed. Now, starting to get to codicology as a discipline and the teaching of it, I'm glad that so many of you talked at length about paleography, because paleography was also the approach everybody took when it came to this tradition. So until François de Roche wrote his introduction to Islamic codicology, really, we always find that people claim you need to be able to read the text, you need to have a really good command of Arabic, and you need to be able to decipher what's in the text, what's around the text, what the colophon says, in order to describe a manuscript adequately. Now, with François de Roche, also from the Sorbonne, probably the colleague of Judith at some point, he's retired now and his successor follows on his approach. He started a new idea of codicology, which is now really kind of taking ground, which is very interesting, where he includes paleography as a part of codicology as a discipline, rather than the other way around. So, of course, we need paleography, and this is probably what brings us closer together to the papyrologists, especially for Islamic codicology. Paleography is extremely interesting because still a lot of analysis is happening through the first evidences of the writing of the Quran, And they really go back to analyzing the script and the style of writing, and for that we still need all sorts of various research on different supports as papyrologists use them. But also we need paleography for dating and for putting a text into its potentially geographic context, as in the Western tradition. But I don't want to talk about paleography here today, but I would rather tell you a little bit more about teaching codicology. As Julia mentioned already, we have an annual weekly course on Islamic codicology in Cambridge, taught by François Desroches, pretty much following the structure of his book. It is, I would really dare to claim, a 20th century discipline, because his approach is to look at a manuscript as an object in the first instance, because however important the textual evidence is, it will always only be found in a portion of the corpus that we have and which has not yet been analyzed. That's one thing. The other thing is also that this modern type codicology, as I dare to call it, opens the field to other specialists, for example, conservators, who then go on and work in a more experimental way, creating samples of codices of the Islamic tradition and actually learn how a book is put together. And this, until then, Islamic codicology was not as accessible to them, really, because of the claims I mentioned earlier. So in the course, we have conservators. They're usually like one or two conservators who do not read the script. The same is for art historians who are often rather focused on the illustration or the ornamentation that they see in the book. Often actually disengaged, so separated from the book. We have many collections in Cambridge at the Fitzwilliam, but also in other collections at Chester Beatty and just worldwide, where the illustrations have been taken out of the book and are curated by a separate person, by a different curator than the manuscripts, the codices. So they often have not many, they don't lose the context at all, and there is no chance for the curator to put the information they are observing into a wider context, because this is not the material they're actually doing. And so are other people who work on material culture and don't necessarily read the script. So what is really his, in the way he pioneered in was to take a systematic approach on the observations we are taking based on the physical item of the book, and put the, absorb the paleography as part of the codicology of the book rather than the other way around. Now, this are some not so great pictures of this year's codicology course, but the way it is organized, it's it goes on for a week, and there are morning lectures. So he's using the structure of the book very systematically and consecutively, and in the afternoon, students have a chance to use my, so we have hands-on sessions, as we call it. They work with the actual manuscript. So every session, when he talks about binding, people look at the binding, look at the quires, they apply formula, and create a description of the manuscript based on the system they are taught in. Now, for the past 2 years, I've taken over one day, only one morning, to try and capture the information they have taken down and observed into a system, into a metadata structure. TI, someone heard of TI? Someone not heard of TI? I'm glad to hear. Which is the metadata system we are using for describing manuscripts, not only Islamic manuscripts, but also Western medieval manuscripts, as my colleague Matthew here in the Bodleian is working on, or Sanskrit manuscript, basically everything that's been described that's a manuscript in Oxford or Cambridge, as far as I know, is using this system, including Georgian, Armenian, and the other traditions. And we've come to the conclusion after so many years of working with this system, well, with this metadata standard that is a whole world in itself, trying to get it into some kind of continuous standard, continuous practice, that we do not need to segregate our applications by discipline or language anymore. We started off having a tailored system for Islamic manuscripts we were extremely proud of. Wow, we're doing something really new, pioneering. And we've come to the conclusion that we work best by having a generic schema, as we call it, that applies to all disciplines, because only then we can actually create compatible data and share our observation in a much wider context. How am I doing for time?
A few minutes more.
Okay, good. Almost finished. So yeah, so that's basically the program. And this is the very rough structure in which we're trying to capture the observations that people do. So this looks as if we had a template, but we don't. It only structures the information in a certain way, but in the same time, text encoding facilitates the encoding of crucial and indexable information from anywhere and in any kind of order, really. So just going back to the colophons that we've been looking at in the previous session, the colophon looks like an excellent bibliographic description. That's how it looked to me, and gives up a lot of information. The colophon, if we were transcribing it and just tagging the information in a semantic way, let's say we tag every name as a name, we tag a date as a date, we can transfer some of it into this structure, or we can leave it. So it doesn't necessarily press us into another, yet another kind of library metadata type of paradigm that limits us in our description, but it allows us to do a lot more with the information that we are recording and apply search methodologies that are then machine readable and can be applied to a large number of data, which is, considering what I mentioned at the beginning, the massive amount of manuscripts that we have, someone estimated up to 1 million or more, is absolutely impossible through the human brain alone. So, as a conclusion, apart from the fact that I think we need more of a generic and comparative approach in general, I also think that the pure scope of material we have really stipulates computational methodologies to be applied. And in fact, I would like to refer to the first two lectures we had, the one by Stuart. I think he basically said something very similar. And you also mentioned how effective it was to work in a group, because then you avoid the idiosyncrasies of every individual coming up with its own terminology and methodologies. So basically, that's another advantage of computational method or digital humanities, that we have more of a unified approach and therefore better results. And go and visit again. And Judith talked about something else interesting that I wanted to pick up on, but I have forgotten now. So we need a systematic approach, and therefore that new code ecology is very useful to keep the observations in some kind of order. And it helps contextualizing the codex as an object and not dropping off everything that doesn't carry the information in the text, but allow us to extract information from the physical and material facts that we can observe and record in a systematic way. Therefore, we need standard and unbiased description, i.e. metadata systems that can absorb that and reflect it. And this way, I believe we can create compatible data and results. Thank you very much.